Welcome to the SEO Insider with your host, Seth Price, founder of Blue Shark, taking you inside the world of legal marketing and all things digital.
Thrilled to have Dave Davies here. He's the co-founder of Beanstalk Internet Marketing. Thank you for being here, Dave.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It is, I've been looking forward to this.
Well, you know, excited to have you here. I miss being out at PubCon and getting to see you speak and talking in the halls. Tell me, we've missed the in-person. What do you see right now? What's exciting you in the internet space?
It is just so constantly changing. I mean, exciting is a funny word right now, because things like GameStop is exciting to me, right? Like in the internet space and the fiasco with Robinhood, but that doesn't have anything to do with internet marketing, really, other than the power that Reddit apparently has to market and get jobs done, which I think was a wake up call for myself included, and going, oh, okay, there's more opportunities maybe in different spots to impact big change. To me, probably one of the most exciting things when I'm looking ahead, like just from a search digital marketing standpoint, was the announcement of the algorithm Smith, to sort of sit on top of the BERT algorithm that rolled out originally. Not in and of itself, like algorithms aren't really a thing, but what that means for things like passage indexing, with which listeners might be more familiar with, but what it means to the passage indexing and the different ways that Google can now index content, which to me just means we as content producers can produce the right content in the right format and trust the engines to sort of figure it out from there.
You know, let's break that down a little bit. You know, for people out there that are trying to figure out a content strategy, I play in the local space, and so we go very deep into silos of content, both by geography and by type of cases somebody might be looking for. Talk to me a little bit what that as you see the algorithm changes and what Google is pushing us towards, what your advice is to people who are trying to create content to comply with where Google is pushing us.
It can be a little difficult right now, because there's one big change. Well, I'm anticipating it will be big. We haven't seen it roll out yet, but I'm anticipating that over the next year to 2 years, it'll be massive, which is passage indexing. It was supposed to roll out in December of 2020, but it didn't. They, I guess, technically weren't able to do that for whatever reason. So we're anticipating it rolling out here shortly. And what that basically will facilitate is a scenario where we can have long form content divided into sections, and Google basically able to better understand a section and rank content based on that section. And I picture it something like featured snippets. If you click the top, and it'll just scroll you right to that block of content, or I don't know, maybe eventually they'll work with light boxes or something like that. But basically, if we combine that with another announcement that they recently had, and by they, I mean Google, in the sort of subcategory indexing, which to me, when they're talking about it, that means they're able to classify multiple pages and rank one piece of content based on what falls beneath it. And then at the same time, looking at passage indexing, which allows them to take a large piece of content and then surface sections of that. It allows us as content producers to go, do I best serve my client by creating clusters of pages that cover topics, like a glossary, for example, would be a simple example? Or would this content better be serving users to create a long form content divided into multiple sections, but go, I'm running a test with a piece on RankBrain and going, if somebody just wants the generic term, this long piece is going to do great if they're just putting in RankBrain as an algorithm. But what is, or how do I optimize for? These are subsections, and that section should be surfaced. So it'll be interesting to see how that impacts once it does roll out.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating. We debate this internally a lot. And while in our space, the skyscraper page is the rage, and getting the pages, you know, up from the 500 minimum to like 2000 or more, 2,500 word pages. But a couple of questions to break into, sort of push on this, which is as an SEO, you have X amount of resources. And so you have a decision. Do you do one 2,500 word page or do you do a 1,000 word page with three supporting pages below it? And you start to sort of, you know, page count versus authoritative page. In a perfect world, it's both, but you have limited resources at some point. And as you get more granular, you can't make, you sort of, you could do this, but then you would have hypothetically a fifth less pages by doing it this way. How do you balance the strengths and weaknesses of increased page count with a very specific topic, getting an additional title tag, you know, getting that more granular, supporting that page versus putting the resources in that Mac Daddy page?
What I'm imagining, and again, with passage indexing, it hasn't rolled out yet, but understanding what Google's done similarly in the past, and reading their documentation on some of the related sort of patents and technologies. I'm imagining what we're going to see, and as soon as it rolls out, we'll know very quickly, that we'd be looking at things like heading tags to serve as titles. We'll be looking at our ability to craft a roughly 150 character little snippet right at the beginning or well placed in understanding in this piece to serve as a description tag.
Like a sub description as a heading where you're going to be able to jump, which is sort of what we want right now, right? When you have those 2,500 word pages, you'd love to have people be able to do the jump link if you're linking into it directly to the point you want. And that's a whole nother thing from the link perspective. Are we getting pure link juice when we do that, when we add those extra jumps within those links?
Well, and that, now we're getting into a super fascinating area, and I love that you brought it up, and I can't quite wrap my brain around how it worked, is I envision things like a, I don't know, like named anchors, right? They go and going back, well, I mean, they're still in use, but sort of going old school and going, oh, okay, if I was jumping to the point on how do I optimize for rank brain, to use my previous example, there'd be a clear aspect of that you'd go, okay, the link to this page is actually talking about how do I optimize for, not the generic topic. Whereas what you're talking about here is not the ability for Google to recognize that a link to a page will be a link to a page, as opposed to a link to a subset, which the multiple page clustering would allow for. Oh, okay, this person is interested in this aspect of this topic. They're interested in how do I optimize for or this specific page of content. I think that aspect will be fascinating. What it is relying on, and we'll soon see if they're as good as I think they are at it, but will be how good are their natural language processing systems? How good is their understanding of the way content should be? And then the relationship of the page linking, the context of that link, and then tying that in and going, okay, what they're actually meaning is to link to this subset, so that maybe not even just in the indexing, but in the, oh, okay, if they link over to this page, it should surface, you know, 2/3 down. It should be surfacing this format of the content.
You know, it brings to something that we struggle with internally, you know, taking from the legal perspective, and everybody has their own, their verticals they play in. But very often there are two, what I'll call money terms, that we need to get for somebody. Let's take the criminal defense lawyer who has criminal and DUI, right? Mm-hmm. They each have lots of subsets under them. And as somebody who does criminal with DUI in the practice, there are people that you're competing against that only do DUI hypothetically, and you're trying to get both. So when you describe those massive pages, one of the things that we sort of are frenetic about is the idea of including that second term in potentially a homepage with that, you know, versus having a standalone page that does nothing but that secondary term. The problem, and this is where the question to you comes, the issue that you sometimes find is, yes, you'd love to have that homepage authoritative built out page with that as one of them, but you don't want to confuse Google between that 2,500 word page there and then the interior page, when it could be, hey, is this your page about the secondary topic, or is it back at that primary page where you have all that information? Would love your thoughts and wisdom on that.
Yeah, that I mean, that's the constant battle in legal real estate. Pick a subject, right? Like that's the constant battle we all face. I'm actually just dealing with that with a client in machine learning. They build machine learning systems.
Okay.
And we're the wrong, quote unquote, the wrong page is ranking, right? Like the page that we want to rank isn't the page that's being surfaced by Google. It is a difficult challenge. The way I tend to look at that, and it works probably 80% of the time. And the other time you got to build links, right? But about 80% of the time is running a sort of quick calculation. Sometimes you can do it anecdotally. Sometimes you actually need to build some spreadsheets and dive into the data is what is the user intent, not my user intent. And I try and remember this every single time and it's really, really hard. But Google doesn't really give a rat's butt what my user intent is. They don't really care what I want my user to do. When a user types in blue widgets, right? Or a user types in a legal term to go into this sector. When they type in that term, are they a high school student running, you know, trying to just write, you know, an essay? Are they a university legal student, right? Trying to get some good definitions and some samples, or do they need help, right? Like which one of these people are they? You want them to need help, right? Like, or most of the clients, right? Like, and this is legal, any sectors like that. I want them to need what I have, but Google doesn't care if my needs are fulfilled. Google cares that their needs are fulfilled. Right. So if the page that I want to rank, it ends up sort of causing some hiccups and problems, but it needs to be balanced, is I need to serve the majority of user intents. I need to be able to fulfill the largest array. I need that high school student to be satisfied. I need that university student to be satisfied. I need my clients to be satisfied. All of this being done in a way that doesn't distract my potential clients with a shiny thing and then send them off into blog post land or something like that, right? You don't want them over there. You just want them to pick up the phone, right? So it's a delicate balancing act of figuring out what fulfills user intent and then the design challenge of going, okay, we need to maximize our probabilities of meeting the user intent, at least more than our competitors. It doesn't have to be every intent, just has to be more than them. It's like backlinks. I don't need as many as Wikipedia. I just need as many as Joe down the street, right? And then 10% more, right? Yeah, exactly. Just one more than him and I win. It's math. So that's where the big challenge comes in as I see it, is making sure that we fulfilled more user intents and done it very clearly. Like, I like to think that Google's machine learning and natural language processing systems are good. They're better than I could build, but they're not great, right? Like they really, like if you've ever used any of their APIs or anything, and most people haven't, so you can take my word for it, they're really not that great, right? Like they're not as good as we would like them to be. They're beyond anything the world has seen before, but they're not perfect. So we do have to sort of spoon feed the algorithm and go, I need to make it really, really clear what these sections are and that I am fulfilling this intent and this intent in that.
You know, one of the things I have asked a lot of our guests and gotten some great answers is, you know, seeing it at conferences, you hear a lot of different people, you know, when you're not on stage presenting, what are some of the biggest myths you think that are out there that people are chasing where they're sort of using precious resources where they probably don't need to be digging as deep?
There's a whole big array, and for anybody, you'll know them, but your listeners, you know, some of them may not. Following John Mu, J-O-H-N-M-U on Twitter, that's John Mueller, right? Like, yeah, I know you'll know him. It's a great way to find all the things that annoy me, because he works for Google and he's sort of, among other things, a mythbuster for Google. There's no one individual thing that really irks me. It's the volume of distraction that SEOs tend to have. A latest one was just a technique for using sort of a button class in styles and JavaScript to create links to pages that didn't actually count as links. And John had to admit that, yes, this is a way it's page rank crafting, right? If you look at a page, it has one sort of vote, I like to think of it. And if there's 10 links on that page, each one gets 10%. Brutally oversimplified, as you know, but that's how we can pass this. If two of those use this button class, that page rank would only be split among 8, right? So now more page rank goes to these pages. I get it. I get the logic. Back in 2008, we were doing that with nofollow, right? Like I understand it, but we've talked about like the time that we feel challenged where do I build this long form content? Do I build this small cluster of pages? If we just focus on doing things like that, like going, okay, let's create, maybe we just go long form instead of a cluster, but then we add video, then we add like infographics. So we're just serving more content needs for different people. That's going to far exceed all these little distractions that we find ourselves chasing down, these little tricks that are probably worked for maybe a year and probably not accomplished nearly what we wanted. And I commented that on Twitter and John was like, basically, yes. I can't remember his exact wording, but.
You know, one of the things that's interesting, you're as plugged in as anybody, do you find historically and now through the present day that you are getting straight answers from Google, or are they telling you what they want you to do despite what may or may not actually be moving the needle?
That's a great question. They do tend to not answer if they don't want to. So which I appreciate. I mean, I understand that every time they say something, there's like a million SEOs all look in to figure out how can I abuse that. I'm one of them, right? Like if they say something and I can use it for my client's benefit, I'm going to. That's why they talk. The current breed, we can compare this with say Matt Cutts of a few years back. He did very polished videos. They were always spot on, right? They always gave great advice, but they were polished videos. He did like once a week or something like that. Now we've got John doing rapid fire on Twitter, or Gary Eyes, or Martin Split, great example as well in sort of more the JavaScript and indexing space. I don't think they lie, but nor do I think they want to. I have seen them be wrong, but they answer off the cuff. I'm wrong when I'm asked questions off the cuff too. And so I think when they do it, it can be more damaging, but I think it's as we listen, we need to be really aware that I'm asking John something he might not know, and the reporters are probably going to take his words out of context to make a great title, right? So there's just sort of like a cluster of misinformation that can happen there.
Right, but I also like look at the early days of COVID with some of the leading thought leaders said, don't wear a mask, where my take was they were trying to protect masks to get to the hospitals when that was
right.
Very, very early on before people said, hey, you can make a cloth mask. And so I'm always, you know, always feel like, yes, I'm listening to it. You take it seriously, but then you're like, okay, is there an ulterior motive for what we're getting? Because they're trying to push behavior a certain way versus, yes, they actually know what's inside the algorithm and they're trying to, help, get you there, or prevent you from doing stuff. How much of it is, because as you just said a moment ago, as people take what they're saying to an extreme, it can drive behavior and can push things too far in one direction, which may not be what they want either.
Well, indeed, you know what, we're in a perfect space to be talking about this. We're in the legal space here right now, right? We're talking legal. So the entire audience can really think of themselves and how they're making an argument when asked a question. And in general, I mean, my father and sister are both lawyers, so I'm aware of sort of the way this goes as well, is you answer as strictly right as you possibly can. You do not lie, but that doesn't mean you need to volunteer more information than you're specifically being asked for. And that's how I try and view everything that they're saying, is strictly, they 9 times out of 10, unless it's an accident, will not be lying. But that doesn't mean they're answering the question to its full intent. It means they're being technically correct in their answer.
Gotcha.
And they're also needing to cover not just what was that question, but what was the breadth of questions that could be involved around that question, right? So they're trying to answer a much broader. But I think more often, I every time they're saying something, I'm going, okay, well, what aren't you saying? What did you omit from this answer that could probably be?
Which is where you start to sort of like almost like a Talmudic scholar trying to parse the words as to what is really meant. And that's then it just your head starts to explode. You know, we spent a good amount of time here talking about content. Let's spend our last remaining minutes. Talk to me about links. Where are you, what your thoughts are these days? What excites you? Where are you spending your time and attention?
Links is a funny one, because like when we tie into the word exciting, because I think very, very rarely in link building do we go, that's exciting. But I mean, basically the core process that we tend to be firing down now, and it's because it is successful, is, and we're talking about content, but we'll circle back a little bit to it, is not sort of forcing my way through as I would have, say, a decade ago, going, okay, I need to jam in links to page X because page X needs to rank, but rather stepping back and going, what are people in this sector writing about? What are people in this sector linking to, right? Like going to Ahrefs or Majestic or whatever, your favorite link building tool, and pull out what topics, BuzzSumo, another great source, right? Like just go in there and go, what are people sharing socially? What are people linking to? And then build that content, but better. And then do outreach, right? Like, so rather than trying to link build to something which can be incredibly difficult, build the thing people will link to. Make sure you're building it into a structure that it's like going to funnel its page rank through well to where you're actually trying to get your rankings, because it's probably not a resource page. You know, and then sort of cluster it in there. I know we've got a lot of clients in travel, and it's like, okay, let's build like big guide areas into this specific town and this specific town, but make sure that it's pushing its weight up really, really quickly. It's a lot easier to build links just with some quick outreach. It's easy to get like the restaurants you're referencing to reference your review of them in this guide area, right? Just trying to keep things as simple as possible. And if you ask Google, all link building is artificial. Well, okay, fine. But this isn't Field of Dreams, and you can't just build it and they will come, right? Like I can't just build great content and go, Google will surface that and lots of links will happen. No, you need to do outreach for these things. But
well, look, the ugly term is link building. The digital PR is sort of the term that's and I guess that was just referenced recently, which essentially is what we're doing. As you see, what was old school PR, you know, the kinder, gentler way of talking about link building is how can you, you know, give people a reason and an opportunity to link in. And even if you are doing stuff that is closer towards middle ground, the idea is if it's from relevant places that make sense, you're, you know, so much better off than the sort of older school, just, you know, as a scattershot, hoping that there's a line following you back from some other place.
Well, indeed. And I mean, you look at, I mean, and rightfully so, like paid guest posting. I mean, it's been like over abused, and it can be a bit of a train wreck, right? We all get those lists in our email. I'm sure all of your like listeners get like this list of like, here's all the sites you can buy stuff on. Okay, well, Google gets that list too. Let's just
get the same list we do.
So that we all do. So, okay, if it's on that list, just ignore it out of the gate. But that doesn't mean that guest blogging is bad. Like going out, there's tons of sites that will accept your great content. But,
I know Matt Cutts had a great video on that back in the day. Because remember, there was a whole, it got really spammy and they said, no, cut it out. He's like, no, it's not that guest blogging is bad. It's guest blogging that's sort of paid artificial versus stuff that is relevant and contextual.
Well, indeed. I mean, I know when I was first starting this company, we obviously didn't rank because I just started a company. We got all of our traffic, all of our business was coming from guest posting on like, you know, some sort of industry site. So just by itself lends value. I try every time I'm building a link to basically go, can I expect traffic? If I can honestly say, yes, I would expect some targeted traffic that I would want, it's probably a good link. I guess.
Well, I'm going to ask you this, which is very often the places that are going to get you the best traffic have the no follow links coming in. What's your feeling on allocation of resources when, you know, do you, how much weight do you put on authority coming from that? There's been a, you know, as far as, you know, the places that are going to get you the best traffic that are great authoritative links very often don't give you the follow juice. You know, how do you put that into your whole rubric of link building?
Yeah, that's a really, really great question. I mean, having a nice balance of sort of strong no-follow links, it has to look natural. I wouldn't necessarily chase most of them. There are exceptions where I can go, okay, the traffic is worth my time, but that's a completely different conversation. We're just talking about link building, right? That's just talking about true digital PR. But included in that is the value of being able to go, and we wrote here, right? If you get your client a mention in People magazine, to be able to go into the next link opportunity and go, we're covered on, you know, entrepreneur, we're covered on people, we're covered in here, immediately that boosts your authority and your success ratios in the ones that you actually do want for SEO value. So you're sort of making your life easier. It's like building that great resource content isn't building a link, but it sure made it easier to bang them out later. So we can get more done later. So it still has that same or an equivalent link value if you've done it right.
you know, I'd love to sort of conclude just finding out from you some of the lessons you've learned building an agency. You know, a lot of agency owners watching this and would love to see sort of like your thoughts. You know, you've pivoted obviously during COVID, but what are some of the things you've seen as you've scaled your agency? What are some of the lessons learned along the way?
Scaling is hard. Right, like just like starting from zero, probably the number one rule. And I've learned this the hard way, and then have now, fortunately, having learned it the hard way. Not everybody, but I was bootstrapping when I started. So saving up front seemed like a really good idea, and taking on too much myself seemed like a good idea. That it wasn't. And that ends up costing. So hiring right, but hiring somebody, basically hire somebody who's smarter than you, to do, I mean, not at everything, right? Like I consider myself quite bright, but, hiring those smart people to do the job, they don't have to be somebody you can train, just pay a little extra to hire people who can think of things you're not thinking of, so that the reliance is no longer on you. Because as long as you're hiring people, you have to train constantly, then you're never free to build your company, right? Like, so, because you'll constantly be babysitting and training and apologizing and then fixing, rather than just going, okay, I'm paying a little extra, but now I can grow my company instead of, you know, repairing and apologizing to clients for work that wasn't up to the standard I would put it at.
Right. Because when you start, as you're touching most things, that it is, you know, you know what you're doing. You're great at what you do. You're very good at it. What are some of the lessons learned in the scaling as you get further away from the sausage making and maybe at the top of a pyramid? What are some of the things you wish you knew, you know, now that you would have liked to implement earlier?
I would hire and find and pay. It's copy is really probably one of the biggest area. The other areas are so easily measured, like a lot of them, where you can just go, oh, okay, I can spot check a few things and just know that everything is going well. I am first to admit it. I'm not a strong copywriter, right? I can write about SEO kind of stuff, but this is not my thing. I don't do design. I don't do copy. Neither of those things particularly well. I can optimize copy, but I can't write it. And finding and paying appropriately the right people in that space for me was what it was. But as a general rule, it's find what you don't do. Admit it to yourself. Be honest with yourself about what you don't do well, and then find somebody who does that far better than you can. At the caliber of what you do best, find somebody who can do that, those things that you can't do well. Find somebody that does what you do best at the same caliber you do, and your clients will be happy.
You know, we've made the move from, you know, an in-house townhouse culture with 50 millennials to a fully, you know, forced overnight into a virtual world, which we really have enjoyed. Mm-hmm. Not so much at the agency, but my law firm, there's a division that the drama level has dropped. Productivity has gone up. There are certain benefits. I don't know how long it's going to last, but talk to me a little bit about that for your purposes, your thoughts on keeping things centralized where you have that sort of serendipity of conversation versus a fully virtual world.
You know, it's interesting because I'm in a smaller city. We've only got 250,000 people in the city I'm in. So we had already done that about 5 years back. I was just like, the talent pool where I am is not robust enough. So by the time COVID hit, it did not, we'd already worked through the growing pains of that transition and already worked through my difficulty in going, they cannot be sitting next to you and still work hard, which all of us have.
That's the psychological part, but there's a cultural component. And part of it's age. Mm-hmm. Like as I get older, I literally can't speak to many of our employees. I have some brilliant people that are very good at talking to them, but I have a select group. And that way, if I can only infect a small number of people with my insanity.
Yes.
The thing that I am curious for people who are ahead of the curve, who have done this for longer, is what are some of the touch points you've implemented to keep culture alive while people are sitting in their bedrooms working very hard. Assuming you get over that, or, you know, you can tech, you have KPIs, you know what they're doing, yes. But it's great. Now they're working hard, but how do you keep a company culture when people are all spread out?
Gotcha. Yeah, that part is incredibly difficult, like incredibly difficult. The number one way, I mean, that I've found things is, first off, one is actually just like trusting that people will just have their own lives, right? Like, and that part's good. And making sure that they're also introduced to our same circles. Like, I have sort of wider circles that we're part of groups on, and making sure that the people that should be are involved in those groupings. It's not even my company culture, but these are my friends and peers. And these are what we're all communicating about. But depending on the specific person, for example, I have an assistant. Her and I chat 3 times a week, like 8 o'clock in the morning, starting our day, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. We have a chat because I need to make sure that she's well acquainted. But the rest of the team, I make sure to meet with at least heads of, like I meet with the head of paid search once a week, just to have a chat. But all not just to talk about what's going on, right? Like as far as technically. But also just to make sure that things are going good, because he's responsible for the paid search team, right? And making sure that all of them are warm and fuzzy, you know, to sort of, you know, candy coat it, and does a great job. And our turnover rate is low, so I know. So I guess maybe in part to me, it was making sure I was hiring personable people that I get along with, and then trusting that they will continue to get along with the people that I'm not talking to as regularly. I try and touch base with everybody regularly enough, but I'm not talking to our paid search team, you know, once a week, but I am talking to the head of the paid search team once a week, and sort of making sure that culture, my communication with him is going well. And it does seem to cascade down. Now, what would I do if I hit a problem? I don't know. I'll let you know if that happens, so we can have that as a tale for another day.
No, it makes me smile, because our president, who's amazing at dealing with managing well beyond his years, we created sort of a forced happy hour. We used to have real happy hours with a keg in the office, and now it is and that was paid. We do an hour of paid happy hour every Friday. That, you know, it's that way. It's not like it's not after work when I ask, but like that's part of the work week, is an hour of socialization above and beyond anything you want to do outside of the office. That's been an interesting experiment that I think that done pretty well.
So you know what? I might actually adopt that. I like that idea. As soon as you said it, I'm like, that's a good idea. I actually do a happy hour with some of my peers, and you're making me think, okay, that's a good idea.
It's a psychological thing, because you're losing an hour of productivity in theory, but you know, it's a question of like, does that build that much more of an esprit de corps? That it's a serendipity that I miss from the in-office.
Yeah.
You know, both good and bad. Seeing where somebody is stumbling, there are certain stuff that if you walk into the room and you see body language, you know something is wrong. You've lost that in the new normal. You've already lost it ahead of time. The other thing that's, and I'll sort of conclude with this, which is we talked before we came on air, was one of the benefits of doing this show is that it is the equivalent of what you just mentioned, which is a way of connecting a bunch of people sitting doing their jobs for us with incredible thought leaders like yourself, who otherwise they would have no real access to other than maybe a formal presentation. So I feel like this has been one of the sort of fun benefits that I didn't realize that the audience not only would be outsiders who would, you know, the shared content is always good in this, the game that we're in, and we spent half of our presentation here talking about creating great content, but that the internal benefits of people getting that conversation off the cuff almost in a serendipity way, where the conversation's taking left and rights, really has turned out to be one of the more interesting things that has come out of this this experiment here with the SEO Insider.
Indeed. Well, I mean, you bring up some interesting points, because there are parts, and I it's sounding like you're there, I'm there, where there's aspects of what we've encountered in 2020 and now into 2021 that I don't want to go back, right? Like, we're doing a lot, I'm having a lot more Zoom chats. I'm doing a lot more, like, you know, chatting with folks like you, and sort of like, okay, we're having like a pleasant chat and getting that chance to interact, where I didn't have to fly to Vegas or Miami to do it, right? But I want to get that back too. But yeah. I see
the tags behind you. You got to keep that going.
Yeah, exactly. And they're a lot of fun, and it's good to like actually sit and have a drink with your friends.
And there's nothing better, in my opinion. But we don't have. But you can scale in a way at a number that you can't do going to Vegas, where you get whoever's in front of you and that's magical, but you're able to do things if you force yourself to here. And I don't know, it's hopefully we get the best of both worlds sooner rather than later.
Indeed. I look forward to sitting down and actually having a real beer with you, not a Zoom happy hour.
Dave, thank you so much for your time. Can't wait to see you back in Vegas.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Thank you for tuning in to the SEO Insider with Seth Price. Be sure to check back next week for fresh insights into building your brand's online presence. Episodes are available to stream directly on Blue Shark Digital's website.